For week two of Call of the Wild, we're going to jump into the second chapter of the book of James. Our message from James chapter 2, verses 14 through 26 is leave no trace. Leave no trace. Here's what James says. He says, "What good is it, my brothers, if a man claims to have faith, but has no deeds? Can such faith save him? Suppose a brother or sister is without clothes and daily food. If one of you goes to him and says, 'Go, I wish you well, keep warm and well fed,' but does nothing about his physical needs, what good is it? In the same way, faith by itself, if it is not accompanied by action, is dead. But someone will say, 'You have faith, I have deeds. Show me your faith without deeds, and I will show you my faith by what I do.' You believe there is one God. Good. Even the demons believe that, and they shudder. You foolish man, do you want evidence that faith without deeds is useless? Was not our ancestor Abraham considered righteous for what he did when he offered his son Isaac on the altar? You see that his faith and his actions were working together, and his faith was made complete by what he did. And the scripture was fulfilled that says, 'Abraham believed God, and it was credited to him as righteousness, and he was called God's friend.' You see that a person is justified by what he does, and not by faith alone. In the same way, was not even Rahab the prostitute considered righteous for what she did when she gave lodging to the spies and sent them off in a different direction? As the body without spirit is dead, so faith without deeds is dead." The phrase "leave no trace," when you talk about camping, or when you talk about hiking, or you talk about backpacking, it has its origin from the 60s. America went from having 33 million visitors to parks to 172 million visitors in 1970. So a fivefold increase. And so they basically formulated this slogan, which was as effective and as powerful as the Smokey Bear: only you can prevent forest fires. This idea of when you go into these areas, what should be your ethics? What should be your mentality? And maybe you're watching now and you have never been to a national park, and you've never camped in a national forest, and you don't really understand the psychology of those who want to conserve the beauty of this area, then the leave no trace principle is a good guiding rule of thumb. Leave no trace essentially boils down to one word, and that word is impact. Minimizing your impact, so that if someone came after you to the same area that you were camped at, that they would not notice your impact. The hope is, leaving, that no one would ever know that you were there. Now, I bring this up because when God comes into a life, it's the exact opposite. When God comes into a heart, what James is saying is that it's a travesty if God has come into your life, but no one can see any evidence that he was there. If God comes into your life and it's only just words, yeah, God's in my life, but people who interact with you see no visible impact of his presence whatsoever. And that's exactly the opposite of what God wants. He wants to disrupt. He wants to change. He wants to heal. He wants to alter. He wants to be where if someone encounters someone who's a follower of Jesus, they can sense him all over the place. In fact, that really is in the back of James' mind as he writes this letter. So what he's saying is, he's saying, once you invite the God of the wild, once you invite the God who breathes out stars, once that spirit comes into you, it's going to change you. It's going to impact you for the better. And he's always going to be wanting more parts of your life. He can work in more areas of your mind that he can have his way. And he's always seeking. He's never done with you. And he's not gotten bored with you. That salvation is not the finish line. In fact, it's just a starter's pistol. It's just the commencement. It's just the beginning. It's just scratching the surface of all he wants to do. His spirit is striving inside of you, wanting to change. Now, I hope you know that God has so much more in store for you. I cannot see and ear cannot hear what God has in store for you. He's just planning and plotting how he can grow you and change you and stretch you and use you, how he can build you to where if you met the version of yourself, you would become 5 or 10 years from now, you wouldn't even recognize yourself. He's not about that leave no trace ethic when he comes to your life, when it comes to your heart, when it comes to your mind. He looks at you and he says, this is a canvas I can work on. Think of it. The God who built the wilderness and had the ingenuity to carve out the Grand Canyon and the Great Barrier Reef and dug the Tetons with his finger, that guy looks at your life and goes, I can't wait to get to work. He's looking at you like, I can't wait. And people may have written you off, and people may have counted you out, but not God. Not God. He looks at you, and if he can breathe life into darkness, he can do something dramatic and remarkable and incredible out of your life. He carved Adam from the dust, and even if your life today feels like dust, you feel like you've made so many bad choices, and you've made so many wrong turns, you just don't know if there's any even hope. God is not dead. If you're not dead, God is not done. He has only yet to begin to work in your life. He wants to leave a trace of his presence. And that's what James is trying to communicate in this passage. In the chapter, in the section that we're reading, that actually begins with the very end of chapter 1, where he says, what is real religion? What impresses God? What lights God's radar up? And he said, it's taking care of widows. It's caring for orphans. That's what he began. Because God is not going to leave no trace. If He's going to work in your heart, it's going to begin to affect other people. It's going to begin to touch other people. You're going to see evidence of His hand everywhere. And James wants to communicate that, but he knows that he is in part talking to some people who had foolishly and falsely come up with an idea of faith that allowed them to say, God's in my life, but show no evidence whatsoever. And so he uses shocking words to get their attention. He understood that there were, and there always will be, people at both ends of the spectrum, both on the legalistic side who are thinking they can do so many good things that God's impressed with them. And then on the other side, there's people who are like, what does it matter how I live? Because I said a prayer one time. What does it matter how I live? Because I own a Bible. Or I'm part of America, which is for sure a Christian nation. So that's got to count for something, right? Or my mom's a Christian, or whatever. There are going to be some people who don't at all have any evidence of Jesus having worked. And they're like, where is Jesus? He left no trace, right? But I said a prayer. That should cover it. I should be good because, like, I'm totally a believer. Because at one point, one time, I said some prayer, did something, crossed myself. Was I, was I playing baseball? Was it assigned to the pitcher? I'm not even sure. But that probably counts too. And there's always going to be both sides of the spectrum. And what we're reading here is shocking language that's intended to feel like, whoa, because it woke you up. Some of you, a couple of verses there, you're like, what? That's weird. Like, James, one of these things just doesn't belong here. The part where you said, right? And what's happening? Well, here's what's happening. Paul and James both communicate about how to have salvation, how the salvation life works its way out. And James, on purpose, picks some language here that people who had been saved under Paul's ministry would go, that's not right. On purpose. To almost make it seem like Paul and James need to talk some stuff out. If they're both going to both write for the same Bible, they should at least get on the same page, right? That's almost what it seems like is happening here. It's like Paul said this and James said that, but you have to understand they're not big enemies. They're actually really good friends. All right? So we're looking at salvation and we're looking at the implications of it and the mechanism of it from two different perspectives when we read James and when we read Paul, for the most part. But I want to show you that actually it's the same thing. You're just seeing coverage of it from both sides. So when we think about salvation, we're talking about having your soul saved. We're talking about going to heaven when you die. We're talking about being redeemed. We're talking about the wrong things you've done being right in God's ledger. So when you stand before Him that you're whole, that you're right, that you're not doomed, that you're not damned, it's being forgiven. It's being made right. That's salvation. And Paul always writes basically on the subject of salvation that it's a gift. It's a gift. You can't earn it. So if you're going to read Paul on salvation, he's going to be going like, hey, don't try to earn it. It's a gift. You can't get it on your own. Like in Romans 3:20, where he says very clearly, therefore by the deeds of the law, Ten Commandments. There's a lot of Christians pumped on the Ten Commandments. All right? Awesome. By the deeds of the Ten Commandments, no flesh will be justified in His sight. For by the law is what? The knowledge of sin. So when we get the Ten Commandments, and we're like, yay, this. All it does, according to this, is say, you are not okay. You have a problem. And you're like, well, I haven't done a lot of bad things. No, think about it this way. The Ten Commandments essentially forms a chain. And you are suspended by that chain. How many of the links in that chain have to break for you to fall? That's the same as how many sins you have to commit to go to hell. You're like, well, if I've done more good than bad, I'm probably okay. That's most people's kind of perspective. God's going to just sort of put my good deeds on this side of the scale and my bad deeds on this side of the scale. And as long as I've done more good than bad, no. Do more links have to break than not break for you to fall if you're hanging by a chain? All it takes is one link. And that's what he says in Romans chapter 3, verse 23. For all have sinned and fallen short of the glory of God. That's a problem. The problem is the reason we were given the law was not so like, okay, everybody, let's try really hard. Let's just not, you know, no one commit adultery. No one lie. You don't steal. Okay, all right, got it. No. All we get when we look in the Ten Commandments is you're screwed, pal. Because if you broke one of them, you're guilty of all of them. All have sinned and fallen from that chain, fallen short of the glory of God. So, how can anyone be saved? It can't be earned. It can only be received. Therefore, Paul says, salvation is a gift. And that's the purpose of Jesus, God's Son who came to this world in human form. Romans 3:28, therefore we conclude that a man is justified by faith apart from the deeds of the law. So salvation doesn't come into your heart because it was deserved. It comes into your heart because it was received by faith. If you believe that God's Son Jesus did what He did on your behalf, that He lived a perfect life, died a death that should have been yours and should have been mine, and instead of staying dead because He was perfectly God and did not deserve and never sinned, He was raised to life. And then He can grant salvation and grant immortality and grant power and forgiveness to anybody who believes in Him. Because only someone who did what he did can make the kind of claims that he made. He backed it up when he rose from the dead. And he said, all right, anybody want some of what I've got? It's all yours for the taking. He's like Oprah. You get one, you get one, you get one. All you got to do is believe in me. So, if you're right with God today, it cannot be, Paul says, because you kept enough good deeds, gave enough money away, did any amount of religious, superstitious services. Whatever you would think, that's what gives me strength. No. By the deeds of the law, zero people are justified. Paul says if you're made right with God, it's because of faith in what Jesus did, who loved us and gave himself for us. So that's what Paul's about. But guess what? That's how James saw it too. James believed the same thing. And he said in verse 18, speaking of salvation, he chose to give birth to us, how? By giving us his true word, a gift. How does new birth come into a heart? Received as a gift. So if you have new birth, was it earned? No. It was received because he gave us his true word. Who's his true word? Who's God's true word? Jesus. John chapter 1, in the beginning was the Word. The Word was with God. The Word was God. He gave us his Son. He gave us his true word. And then look at this. And we, out of all creation, became his prized possession. How precious is it to be loved by God? How precious is it that God says, you sinful, broken, damaged, treacherous, a traitor, an idolater, murderer, I love you. I will die not just for you, I will die as you. And you're now his prized possession. You are loved. You are loved by God. Go to sleep tonight. I don't care what you do today. I don't care what goes wrong. Go to sleep tonight just remembering, like, let it be your last thought. I'm God's prized possession. I'm loved by God. The enemy will whisper that you don't matter. He'll whisper that the world would be better without you. You know it's a lie. The devil is a liar, and he's a thief, and he's a murderer, and he has been so from the beginning. The truth is, you are loved by God. The truth is, you can never add to or subtract from his love. You'll never have it be based on you, but placed for you. It's a mess to live a performance mentality where it's always rising and falling. I had a great week, so God must really be proud of me. I had a productive day, so wow, I feel so important. No, you're just loved. You're just loved. Before you do anything, you are loved endlessly by God, who made you his prized possession. He could have picked any part of creation. He chose you. And you were on the mind of Jesus as he cried out, Father, forgive them, for they do not know what they do, before he died on the cross. So what's salvation? Paul and James saw it's a gift. All right. Now, what about all this that James is all about? Because James is like, nope. Here James is saying stuff like verse 17. Isn't it obvious that God talk without God acts is outrageous nonsense? And we're, you know, that's out of the Message translation there. I think he puts it so well. James is saying, but hold on. Yes, he already established it. Chapter 1, verse 18, salvation is a gift. New birth comes not from earning it, but because God gave it and made us his prized possession. So the gospel in James is clear. What is it? It's a gift. He's already said that. But what is that he's also wanting us to understand is if that God who breathes out the stars comes to live in you, you will live differently. If God comes in you, there's going to be a trace. There's going to be signs of life. When he comes and camps inside your heart, he packs heavy, right? He brings his gifts. He brings his spirit. The Spirit strives in you earnestly, always wanting, intensely desiring to have more and more of you. He's not going to leave you the way you were. He's going to be changing and stirring and tweaking and messing and fixing and prodding. He is an intense person to have stay in your heart forever, right? So, yes, James says, salvation is a gift, but he also goes, and if the gift's received, it's going to have an impact on your daily life. You live differently when God lives in you. And guess what? Paul said the same thing. So we saw salvation from Paul's side that we normally look at. And then we got to flush out from James going, yep, okay. But now let's see Paul telling us the same thing that James just told us, okay? This is just a couple of chapters later in the book of Romans, chapter 6, verse 1. After establishing the power of the gospel, that it's not earned, never deserved, only received on the merit of what Jesus did when, you know, he died on the cross. Then he goes, well, what shall we say then? Shall we continue in sin that grace may abound? Because he had just finished saying, where sin abounds, grace abounds even more. So, you feel like you're so bad, God can't forgive you? Guess what? The worse your sin, the bigger God's grace. Then he said, so should we then go, well, I want to sin more that grace may abound more. Like, yay. Like, you're going to see it go down tonight. If that's true, I can always apologize tomorrow. You're telling me the salvation's in Christ. It doesn't really matter. There's no sin so big. Then let me rack up some sin. Then, you know, have some fun. Because I already said that prayer, so I'm probably good. Should we do that? Paul said. Then he answered his own question. Certainly not. And that's such an intense phrase. Certainly not. Should we just sin it up since Jesus died on that cross for us? Like, we're good. He already paid our bill. Paul says no. Paul says don't be crazy. Paul says certainly not. How shall we, he says, who died to sin, live any longer in it? How could you possibly think that way? How could you, in your minds, think Jesus struggled to breathe on a cross, dying for my bill, and I'm going to stand at the foot and go, while you're up there, Could I throw a few more sins on I haven't gotten around to yet? Paul says, so from the perspective of someone who identified as the chief of sinners, he couldn't believe God would ever forgive him. He couldn't believe God would forgive someone like him who murdered Jesus' followers. And so for him who is so grateful to be forgiven and so unbelievably amazed by the power and wonder of grace to think that anybody would then be cavalier or calloused or in any way clinical about, oh yeah, bill's been paid, we're good. To him, it just doesn't compute. That just does not resonate with the heart of someone who's had the God of the universe forgive them. And so what does Paul say? Paul says what James says. If God comes to live in you, your whole perspective changes. You live differently. He leaves a trace. He doesn't just take photos and leave footprints. He brings in the wrecking ball. He's changing stuff. He's working and he's causing you to see things differently. You won't even recognize yourself. What you once cared about, what you once obsessed about, what mattered the most to you before, you're like, no, I'm a different. I see it differently. I'm changed. I've been bought. I'm not headed to hell. I'm not dead. I'm alive. I have the Spirit. I have heaven. I have the family of God. I have this opportunity. I just want to please Him. I want to do what makes God happy. Oh, so He doesn't cast you in hell? No. He already decided that. He's not going to. He promised me He wouldn't. I want to live not to earn His favor, but because I have this favor. And that's the difference. That's the shift. That's the pivot. That's the place we come to once we understand the power of grace. And because, yes, there's no sin you can commit as a Christian that He couldn't forgive, but following that makes you not want to take advantage of that. Think about it, how if you were in a restaurant and someone came to your table and said, hey, just so you know, the bill's been paid. You're like, oh, I haven't given my card yet. No, another family was in here. They took care of your bill for you. Would your immediate reaction be like, wow, you know, we should order dessert too? Like, that's not your mentality. The mentality is how gracious of somebody to do that for me. How kind of somebody to think of me in that way. And you're almost in your heart like, man, do I have any, you know, do I have any cash on me? Because if they already paid the bill, I'm not going to have the chance to write a credit card tip. I need some cash to leave an extra tip. I want to make sure that's taken care of. Your mentality changes when you really comprehend the power of a sacrifice. And so that's what Paul says on salvation. What James said. And that's what James says about what happens when God comes to live in you. Which is what Paul says. So really, it's the same perspective. One is speaking, Paul speaking, about how to get saved primarily, and James is primarily trying to communicate about how to know you're saved and how to live out of the power of salvation so it can impact the rest of the world. The chief confusion comes down to the use of the word justified in verse 24. When Paul and James speak about justification, that's what causes the biggest confusion. But I think what clears it up is knowing that there are two uses of the word justify. Justify, of course, is a legal term. It's a court term. And we think of a court declaring someone acquitted, justified. You go free. And that's what happens when Christ died for you. You were justified. When you receive that salvation, God the Father slams the gavel down. Case dismissed. You're free. It's like you never sinned. Just as if I'd never sinned. That's an easy way to remember justified. Just as if I'd never sinned. That's how God looks at you. But that's not the way James uses it. Because there's a secondary use of the word justification. Because when you talk about the court sense, we're talking about something being made righteous, something being made to be true, declared to be true. But there's also a sense in which justification can be proving something's true. I couldn't go to school today. I'm sick. Awesome. Going to need to see a doctor's note. What are you doing when you bring the doctor's note to your school? You're justifying the absence. Reconciling credit card receipts. Oh, it's a business expense. Cool. Who was at the dinner? What was discussed? Was it business? Or was that actually not? You're justifying the use of those resources. You're in that case not making something true. You're proving something's true. So when Paul talks about justification in his letters, he is almost always using the first sense. And talking about justification as God's action of declaring us righteous. That's how he almost always uses it. But James is using it in the secondary sense here when he says in verse 24, a person is justified by what he does and not just by faith alone. He's using the second definition. He's saying something is not made to be true by the works, but proved to be true by the works. In fact, he's saying, this is how you can know you're a Jesus person. And this is how the world will get to see that you're a Jesus person. Because he came into your heart, and that act of justification, you then get the opportunity to prove that it really happened to the world by getting to see the traces that he has left all over your heart and your life by the way he has changed your soul. Hopefully that clears it up for you just a little bit. And this is important stuff here because as G.K. Chesterton once put it, by far the most powerful argument against the truth of Christianity are Christians. The biggest argument against the truth of Christianity are Christians. What Jesus says seems great, but I have met some Jesus people. Now maybe you've met some people that James wrote to correct. Maybe you've met some people who think that just owning a Bible is enough, or just being able to check Christian in a box is enough, or having said a prayer is enough, but haven't actually seen Jesus invade their souls and invade their lives. And we are called to be people that are winsome, that are loving, that people who are around us, who don't even believe what we believe, love how we live. And that's the key word, love. You have friends in your life, like, you know, I don't know about that person. They don't seem to be much of a friend. But look at God. That's a friend. What a great friend to have. God wants to bring you to a place where heaven invades your soul. Where heaven invades your soul. Climbing up a mountain, scaling a mountain, is, you know, opening up your heart to Christ is better. And watching that wild invade your soul.